Thank you, Stephen. Well, I thought there may be a few other personal bits coming out there. Maybe I can add some of those as my personal history. Actually, I used to be a college professor, and so I promise not to be too nerdy today. But actually, I made it my way through grad school as a disc jockey. One does what one has to make money, one's a grad student. But I promise today not to go into refrain of staying alive. But when we talk about energy, it really affects us all. I mean, it's a topic that impacts everybody, no matter where we are in society. And so really, a topic of energy, whether you're living in Brazil or living in the UK or living in Australia, it affects us all. I mean, the use of energy is so pervasive in our personal and working lives and the economy that we barely think about it until we pull up at the petrol pump or pay the electricity bill. And energy is delivered to us easily and efficiently. We take it for granted. But for many people in poor countries, energy is scarce and expensive compared to their daily budget. And for these people, access to energy brings a better life. And I can talk about my life, actually, how that's changed as energy became more available. People find this hard to believe, but I grew up in Britain in the late 50s, and the only energy source we had in this rural cottage was one coal fire. We had one coal fire and a Calicast bottle for the stove. I remember as a young kid going up the stairs carrying a candle to find my way to bed. And you know, Britain can be kind of cold winter time. You wake up and breathe out and see the vapor condense on the bed. I mean, but that was Britain in the late 50s in rural areas. But eventually we got electricity. And then we got a refrigerator. Then we got a telly. I don't know if the telly came first, actually, but we got a telly and a refrigerator. And all of a sudden we got a better life. And we started to do more things. And I remember in the late 50s, we didn't have a car. We had a motorcycle, a motorbike and sidecar. And I would sort of sit in the sidecar with my mum, and we'd be covered with a canvas. And my poor old dad getting soaked, as it often rains in Britain, as you all well know. But eventually in 1960, we got a car. And all of a sudden, life started to get better. We could go on holidays. We could go further. And this is the exact same thing that I've been fortunate to go through in my not-so-short life now, but relatively short life. Is what a lot of the developing countries are going through today. For example, today in Australia we have 55 cars for every 100 people. In China it's only 3 cars per 100 people, in India only 1. And a lot of this debate about energy, we need to make sure that we use energy more efficiently, absolutely. But we also should make sure that we don't take the moral high ground as a developed country and deny those people in developing countries a better life. We certainly enjoy a great life today, enabled by energy, and we need to make sure that others can also have that same kind of life. So energy really impacts us all. Well, let's go on now to energy consumption by region. North America and Europe dominated energy demand in the second half of the 20th century. But this chart shows developing countries will dominate growth in the first half of this century, particularly those developing countries in Asia. This shift is fundamentally affecting energy supply demand and energy trade. Those people are getting a better life, and they deserve it. How can we do it the right way is the question. But energy consumption in the form of fossil fuels is a large part of the climate change problem. We all face threats from climate change with scenarios that vary from serious to disastrous. We must all be part of a global solution that greatly reduces greenhouse gas emissions while maximizing economic growth. Carbon pricing and other regulatory interventions to address climate change will fundamentally reshape energy supply and demand. We shouldn't underestimate the changes that we're going to go through. There's another major factor affecting our future, limited oil supply. It's generally accepted that oil demand will outstrip conventional oil supply in the foreseeable future, leading to higher oil prices or even oil price shocks if supply is very tight. This often goes under the heading of peak oil. And I think a lot of us have seen certainly in the last few months, the concern about peak oil. It's waned a little bit now because of economic concerns, but the trend has certainly been up, as we will see in a future chart. This chart actually shows crude oil supply flattening off by about 2020, which is only just over 10 years from now, and increasing reliance on the Middle East, Africa, and the former Soviet Union for those oil supplies. Over half the world's proven oil reserves are in the Middle East. And the chart on the right shows the rapid increase in oil supply from unconventional sources, including heavy oils, tar sands and biofuels. So let me point this out. This sliver of unconventional supply is magnifying what is the green bar on the chart there. And actually, a lot of that is Canadian extra heavy oil, which is the oil that's locked in tar sands in northern Canada. And actually, when you include this non-conventional oil, there is almost as many oil barrels in reserves in Canada as in Saudi Arabia. So there's actually a large amount of oil available. The question is at what price? And one of the concerns with the non-conventional tar sands, it needs a huge amount of energy, particularly gas, to heat up those rocks to get the oil out. So it's not very energy efficient. But certainly there is oil there in large amounts in Canada. But we are likely to experience a shortfall in conventional crude oil supply versus the trend in oil demand sometime in the next 2 decades, although the exact timing is subject to debate. And it's very interesting, actually, if you look at some of the peak oil theorists, they're not projecting that oil is going to suddenly stop being available tomorrow, but their forecasts are saying maybe in 20 years' time there'll be as much oil production as today. It's not going down rapidly, which I think is the natural nature of things, that things always evolve, they don't rapidly change. And so the oil company is saying oil production may go up over the next 20 or 30 years, but maybe only about 20%, not in line with demand growth. But peak oil theory is saying it will stay effectively flat after it peaks about 2020. So there is time to evolve towards new energy sources. As the next chart reminds us, and this is the oil price chart that everybody loves to look at, let me explain this. It's in real and nominal terms. So real is when you take out inflation. Let's just look at nominal, which is the blue line. So that's in today's dollars where we are. And it's certainly a very rocky ride. And I've been in this business over 25 years, and the only thing you can be sure of, there'll be uncertainty and volatility. But it's an interesting ride that we've been on recently with this rapid run-up in prices. And this chart reminds us that we recently experienced unprecedented high oil prices in nominal dollars per barrel, and about the same price in real inflation-adjusted terms as the first oil shock. So in real terms, just for inflation, what we've suffered recently is what we had in the 70s. It hasn't had as negative impact because we need, as we'll see in a later chart, less energy per GDP in developed countries. So we've had to ride this much better than what we had in the 70s. But in those real terms, the oil price recently is about what it was in the 70s in those very difficult times for economies. Should be noted, though, that the data used in this chart is from a few months ago, and there's now been a drop in oil prices to around $70 US per barrel. But of course, our Australian dollar has come down as well. And so actually, in Australian dollars, we're still sitting about $100 a barrel, which historically is very high. So we can't ignore what the market is telling us, which is to reduce our reliance on crude oil. It won't be there in the volumes we need for the energy growth that's likely to take place. This next chart shows how the world is heavily dependent on fossil fuels for energy supply in the form of coal, oil, and gas. And you can see this projections out to 2050, and the black is the coal. Coal is abundant. The key is because it's concerned with the CO2 emissions from coal, but it's quite likely, and this is a Shell report, that coal will be increasingly required out to 2050. And we can see oil, see that peak, oil is coming off by 2050 after peaking around about 2020, 2030. And gas is also playing a very important role. And we layer on top of that nuclear globally, as well as biomass or biofuels and other renewables. So it shows we're going to be heavily dependent on coal, oil, and gas for many years to come. Conventional biofuel, particularly biofuels from food crops, is substantial but also not sustainable in many countries because of the depletion of natural resources. This dependence will be very difficult to change because of rapid growth in the developing world led by countries like China, India, Brazil, and Indonesia, and the current cost of switching to alternative energy sources such as nuclear and renewables. So if you actually look at what we need, it says conventional fuels, the oil, the gas, the coal, just can't keep up with the growth. We need all the renewables that we can get. In fact, the world's demand for energy due to the growth in developing countries keeps on growing. And there is no one-size, one-answer-fits-all. And though conventional fuels may start to peak as a percentage, they're still a very large and growing part of the mix when you add coal, which is growing. So we need renewables. We can't all go to wind or renewables. Actually, we need it all if we're going to meet the energy demands that the world has. And that growth in developing countries has serious consequences for greenhouse gas emissions, which makes a global agreement on reducing emissions an absolute imperative. We just can't do it alone in Australia. It takes almost like the world has got together to try and solve the bank problem. The world needs to get together to solve the climate change problem, and hopefully we can before it's too late. This chart shows world oil consumption from 2004 to 2008. And this shows the growth in oil, not the absolute amount, because we consume today about 86 million barrels a day of oil. But China and other developing countries dominated growth. I think that's an important thing to point out. And the developed countries of the OECD reduced their oil use over the period. So if we look at over this four-year period, the total growth in oil up to about the 86 million barrels a day that we use today has been about 4 million barrels. It's going up about 1 million barrels a day per year. So total growth about 4. So we've gone from just over 82 to over 86. That growth, though, has been China, Middle East, Latin America, the developing countries. In fact, the OECD, the developed countries, are using less oil today than we did 4 years ago. So it goes to the point we're a lot more energy efficient in oil per unit of GDP. But certainly oil demand is growing globally, but led by the developing countries. So actually now let's turn to oil use in GDP. How does this all fit in? This chart relates oil use to economic output or GDP. So if we look here, for example, this is the US. This is their GDP per capita in a fairly stable population. And this is the barrels of oil per capita. So you can see the US has been essentially flat over that time period, as has Australia. You can see the way that oil use per unit of GDP in the US, Australia, and Japan is high but flattened off, which says we're getting much more efficient in how we use oil over the last few decades. China, India, and South Korea have a much lower incomes but lower oil use per unit of GDP. In these countries, if they try to increase their use of oil to the level of developed countries, the supply just simply would not be available. They're rapidly using more oil per unit of GDP, but if they tried to use as much oil as the West does currently, there just simply isn't the amount of oil. So one can imagine what the impact of that on supply demand. It seems likely there will be a global agreement by 2010 on reducing growth in greenhouse gas emissions, even though highly imperfect and differentiated between countries, done in a differentiated way. When nobody's going to do exactly the same thing. May well be like how we responded to the bank crisis. Each country did it slightly differently, but the end result was positive. Australia and other developed countries will commit to substantive action, and I think that's what we're going to be talking about a little bit later. There's certainly lots of good actions planned. The key is to make sure we get there. This raises a question of whether Australia should be planning an emission trading scheme when there is a global economic crisis and possibly a recession. A number of commentators said we should stop this, but our view is that a scheme should be put in place as soon as it can be properly designed, but its implementation should take account of economic conditions and international climate change negotiations. So let's keep forging ahead, let's do the right thing, let's do it at the right pace. We can't afford to stop. It's too important an initiative to stop. Australia can take international leadership position in policies to reduce carbon emissions, but until there is global commitment to emission reduction, Australians' emission trajectory should be modest and ensure a low carbon price initially. For example, Australia emits about 1% of the world's total CO2, so what we do is important, but we can't change the world alone. But we can certainly show leadership. A scheme in Australia, for example, with a fixed price could be an alternative to a market-determined price while an international agreement is negotiated, then implemented to provide a level playing field for our economy versus other economies. Again, we need to remember that Australia can't go it alone. even if Australia massively reduced its emissions, there would be almost no discernible change in global concentrations of greenhouse gas emissions and no change to global warming or rising sea levels. All the world's major emitters need to take substantial action to reduce emissions, or, in the case of the poorest countries, reduce their growth in emissions. And certainly, as we look at these charts, the developed countries have been able to reduce their oil usage and hence emissions from oil as they got richer. It is not impossible. It can be done. So we need to make sure we can work with the developing countries to ensure that they can have a similar trajectory like South Korea has achieved over the last few years as a developed country. It can be done. If Australia is to meet its target of 60% reduction in greenhouse gases by 2050 relative to 2000, radical changes in energy supply and demand will be necessary. Note that a 60% reduction relative to 2000 is a 77% reduction relative to business as usual in 2050. That just underscores the huge changes that we need to be contemplating. And that's the good news. The bad news is that Professor Garnaut has advised we need about a 90% reduction of greenhouse gas emissions in 2050 relative to business as usual, a 90% reduction compared to where we'd otherwise be. This is the size of the challenge that we have. Well, let's move on now to Australian energy supply and greenhouse gas emissions. This chart is from the final report of the Garnaut Review. The 60% line, that's the green line, this shows emissions over time. This is business as usual. These are emissions over time with various reductions compared to 2000. The 60% line shows progress towards the government's target of a 60% reduction in emissions. The 80% line, that's the middle line, is what would be required for Australia to play its part in rationalising the global atmospheric concentration of greenhouse gases at 550 parts per million. Professor Garnaut regards this as the necessary international target to avoid dangerous climate change. The 90% line is what would be required to stabilise the atmospheric concentration of greenhouse gases at a more satisfactory 450 parts per million. So we're talking about the requirements on these bottom two curves. Leaving aside nuclear power, the only way Australia can meet its 2050 target or more stringent targets is through heavy reliance on low-carbon electricity and biofuels. Both climate change and the oil market are driving us in the same direction. So actually, the forces are naturally coming together. Greater efficiency in the use of liquid fuels and the diversification of supply are taking us towards this end state. The question is it at the appropriate pace? Let's look at the Australian transport emissions now. Again, this is the business as usual case, the top line. And the other lines from Garnaut are if we went on the 550 ppm global case, in other words, doing our part to get to 550, and the blue line is we did our part to get to 450. So these are the two lower scenarios we had in those percent reductions earlier. This chart from the Garnaut report shows transport emissions are fairly flat through the middle of the century in the 550 ppm scenario. This is the result of substantial usage of fossil fuels over the next 40 years, followed by almost complete electrification of transport in the second half of this century to help achieve the 550 ppm target. I mean, what this says is vehicle fleets and the availability of new energy sources doesn't take place immediately. It takes decades. And we're starting to begin now, and that trend needs to continue, but we just can't suddenly substitute fossil fuels with something else because it just simply isn't available. And it will take several decades to get that turnover, but we need to be starting now. If we look at electricity generation, the other big emitter of CO2, in fact the biggest emitter, Caltex recently participated in the Future Fuels Forum led by CSIRO, which generated a number of scenarios of fuel supply through to 2050. We selected some charts from this study to illustrate our points. These charts are broadly consistent with the Garnaut report. There are many sources of low-carbon electricity, including solar, thermal, wind, geothermal, wave, biomass, photovoltaic, and hydro that are suited to various applications and locations and should be allowed to compete for market position. We need them. Coal and natural gas with carbon capture and storage will play an important transitional role until stringent targets and high carbon costs reduce their viability. Again, it's managing the transition. We can't have a sudden change because the energy is not there and available. And you can see, look at this, these are the charts. So here's hydro at the bottom, small but significant. Then we've got the whole variety of coals in these higher levels. And then, as we see, as we start getting into this latter part or mid-century, that's when hopefully wind can start to play an important role, but it's coming off a very low base. And a number of new technologies and evolving technologies need to come to the fore to play their role. But until those come to the fore, we're still going to rely to a large extent on fossil fuels. And really, the 21st century is maybe the transition away from fossil fuels, but that's a transition that needs to take place over several decades while we develop the other technologies. Let's now look at distance travelled by engine type, for those of you that own a car, which is probably for most of you. As the chart shows, and this is for Australia, internal combustion engines will be around for a long time yet. There is no substitute yet that is commercial and technologically viable for the major turnover of the fleet yet, but it will come. There may be use of petrol or diesel for some proportion of biofuels, and they may become more efficient through the use of hybrid technology. But even though they're hybrids or using biofuels or diesel, they're still internal combustion engines. But pure electric vehicles or even plug-in hybrids will remain relatively expensive over the next few decades, This is why the market for fossil fuels for transport is projected to hold up well over the coming decades. And this is actually from CSIRO. And you can see in black we've got the internal combustion engine, and actually the kilometres travelled is growing through till about 2025. That's another 20 years almost. But only then do mild hybrids, the yellows, start to take over. Maybe at the beginning of electric vehicles, about 2025, to have some kind of impact. And then plug-in electrics, maybe towards 2030 and beyond. So again, this is a time of transition. We need to manage that transition well and develop those technologies. What about Australian transport fuel consumption? This chart looks at transport fuel consumption in more detail, and it's a bit busy, so let me explain it. Again, this is in CSIRO, and this is a chart that goes out to 2050. The purple at the bottom is aviation fuel, which continues to grow through the middle of this decade. It is very difficult, though people are starting to look at it, to find a biofuel or some other substitute for conventional hydrocarbon aviation fuel. For example, there's concern if you have fat-based biofuels, those do plug up at low temperatures, and the last thing you want on a jet aeroplane is to have your fuel injectors plugging up. If we look at petrol, it takes different forms. The blue is conventional petrol, which is 100% hydrocarbon, but also there's petrol which is either blended with 10% ethanol and eventually 85% ethanol. So petrol will be around, albeit more and more with biofuel blends, for many years to come. Diesel is actually likely to grow over the next few years for personal transport, because actual diesel emissions of CO2 are a lot less per kilometre travelled. The new clean diesel, and starting January 1st next year, Australia will sell the strictest specification diesel in the world, in line with Western Europe. That diesel, that high efficiency diesel engines that go with that diesel, have low CO2 emissions per kilometre travelled. That's why in countries like Britain, for example, with company cars, they actually are mostly diesel these days, because the personal tax liability on a company car is tied to its CO2 emissions per kilometre. And diesel is a very efficient mode of transport. So diesel is likely to continue. It will keep growing for off-road use, like mines and so on. Then we layer on top a more pure biodiesel, and eventually more substitutes will come in, like coal to liquids, making fuel from coal, which they've done in South Africa for many years, but petrol from coal and diesel from coal. Gas to liquids, turning remote gas into diesel, and eventually we've got electricity. But again, it doesn't really start to play a major role in the transport fleet until 2020, 2030. So beyond the fuel for transport, as I said, there's also fuel growth, though, in other sectors, notably diesel for mining. Terrific growth in Australia the last few years and likely to continue. Biofuels like ethanol and biodiesel will be important in the transport applications, where electricity is impractical. So even by mid-century, we're still saying that liquid fuels will be very important, even 40 years from now, when there are likely to be a lot more electric cars. This is the CSIR study of this year. Well, as an oil company, of course, we're very interested in this. Caltech has a focus on the future of liquid fuels, as that is the core of our business. Caltech is also the largest convenience store retailer in Australia, and this is a growing part of operation. So we're more than fuel, we're also in the convenience store is a new version of the old corner shop I grew up with, a growing part of the business. But over the next several decades, Caltech will continue to evolve our fuel marketing operations, because you certainly look out next 20, 30, 50 years, there's a lot of fuel to be marketed. We are the leading supplier in Australia of fuels, and today actually we're also a leading marketer of biofuel blends. And to retain our position as the leading fuel marketer over the next decades, will likely be greatly increasing the amount of biofuel sold. It's ramping up off a low base, but certainly rolling out very quickly. Our refineries, which produce the sort of the hydrocarbon fuels, will also likely continue to provide substantial volumes of conventional liquid fuels, even in 2050. In the CSIRO study scenarios, these fuels are blended with ethanol and biodiesel, and net petrol and diesel consumption remains high. So even moving out in sort of 20 years from now, more of the petrol will be blended with ethanol, and eventually, another 30, 40 years, more of the diesel is blended with biodiesel, but you still need that base blending stock to make the final fuel. Well, what about Australian product demand? This is Caltex's outlook for fuels over the next few years to 2020, and this is actually consistent with the CSIRO study that we just looked at. The outlook on this chart shows that we think till 2020, the demand for petrol is fairly flat, growing at 0 to 1% a year. And that's been that way for some time, fairly flat. Diesel continues to grow at about 4% per year, largely led by the mines that continue to grow, but also the emerging passenger car fleet that is now going to diesel. In fact, about 20% of all new SUVs bought in Australia and now diesel because of the higher fuel efficiency. Diesel growth more recently has been much higher than this, but this is a long-term forecast to 2020. And jet fuel will continue to grow at about 3 to 4% a year. So over the next 15 years or so, there is still quite strong growth in fossil fuels as the world starts to emerge and have more other types of fuels available. But if you look at today, Australia imports about 25 to 30% of all petroleum products that we use. And certainly when we look at that, that's one of the issues around refining. We are short refining in this country. And if more refineries don't keep operating here, then we could easily be importing 50% of our fuel. In fact, market growth will get us to that point. And one can easily imagine a scenario 15 years from now when Australia is importing 70% or more of its fuel. And that's a long supply chain from anywhere to Australia. And we certainly know how oil and products have been used as a weapon historically. We certainly not want to be vulnerable. To keep our options open is important. But certainly this is a rising amount of imports and something that is very important to beware of. Because in fact, if you look at Caltex, we actually fuel a third of Australia. A third of all transport fuels consumed in Australia come from Caltex. So we regard that as not only an important role for our business, but an important role for Australia and the economy, keeping a third of Australia going. Let's look at the advanced vehicle technologies. Picture of some nice fancy cars there, you can see. But they're coming. Advanced technology is coming. It will just take time. Conventional vehicles will dominate for many years, but new technologies are starting to evolve. This starts to show the technological feasibility of large reductions in transport emissions, but the cost of these vehicles will remain relatively high. We're already seeing the start of this shift with mass-produced petrol-electric hybrid cars, and certainly the Toyota Prius is leading the way, which will lead the way to vehicles that rely partially or completely on renewable mains-based electricity. Alternative liquid fuels with a smaller carbon footprint will also play a role and will include biofuels from sustainable feedstocks, maybe second-generation biofuels, synthetic petrol, and diesel and hydrogen. Natural gas and LPG are already used as transport fuel, so the mix will steadily change. So the vehicles look kind of the same, different motors, more batteries, more hybrids, but we're now in that transition phase. It's probably going to last 3-4 decades. So we look at Caltex. We're the number one, and we still say we're going to be growing as the fuel retailer and convenience market in Australia. And we see this outlook and say this is a great time to be in this business. Because you may think that the future will become increasingly challenging for oil refining and marketing. And having been in the business for 27 years, just about, it's never been easy. So people say it's easy. Forget how the cycles we've been through. But however, the changes I've discussed will take place over an extended period relative to the life of current investments. So the key to success is the ability to adapt to changing times. And so what are the facts? Well, if you look at the growth in petrol demand in Australia, as we said, it's about zero. However, diesel has continued to grow strongly because of demand from road transport, mining, construction, and agriculture. Jet fuel, which is a kind of light diesel fuel, is also growing strongly, as we saw. In recent years, this has increased diesel prices globally relative to petrol, and these global prices are the basis for price in Australia. A lot of people say to me, well, why is diesel so much more than petrol now? Diesel is a byproduct, isn't it? Well, actually, the high refined diesel that is sold in Australia today and more refined come next year is a very fine product, and the world is short diesel. The industrial demand growth has gone up so much around the world, and typically diesel almost goes up with GDP, that diesel demand is so much stronger now and the world is short. And in fact, 15 years ago in Australia, for every 2 litres of petrol consumed, there was 1 litre of diesel. Today it's 1-for-1. There's as much diesel consumed in Australia as petrol today. And that it won't be long before more diesel is consumed than petrol. And that's a trend that's going on around the world. So the world is short diesel. The impact of current global economic conditions and the crude oil price will have an impact on the demand for petroleum products in the shorter term. And refining margins in the short term will be soft as more refining capacity comes on stream in the next 12 to 18 months. As refineries plan to come on, and this is the world demand growth, still demand growth, but it's softening compared to recent history. Now, refining is a tough business at the best of times, just like any other manufacturing business. Competitive pressures could mean some of Australian refineries will close, but many of Australia's refineries, perhaps all, could be competitive in the long run. The key is to make sure you take the right actions. We've now been, as Caltex, building our marketing operations for a number of years now. The marketing-focused model is part of our business evolution. It keeps us aligned with a world in which carbon prices, oil prices and demand-side technologies are all changing within the time frames of current investments. Caltex is investing in new and upgraded terminals around Australia to increase our flexibility and increase diesel demand, to bring in more diesel from offshore because we're short diesel in this country, for Australia's resource industries and our customers. We've also acquired wholesale operations that fit our marketing objectives. Now, Caltex is also diversifying its fuels portfolio, as I've discussed, with investments in terminals and service stations to sell biofuel blends to retail and commercial customers. It's very interesting, actually. Caltex now supplies about 2,000 service stations across Australia, either as a wholesaler or a retailer. We're now at the point where almost 20% of those have a biofuels offering. It's either ethanol-blended fuels, biodiesel blend, or both. And that's been ramping up very rapidly over the last few years. Because biofuels can have a much lower life cycle greenhouse gas emissions than petrol or diesel, but the challenge with biofuels is to produce them sustainably from non-fuel crops. And that's where this next generation, second generation biofuels are coming in, where you can produce the biofuels from the stalks, the stems, the byproducts of food crops. And so we're now in the early phases of getting customer acceptance around biofuels, but the next wave is yet to come, and that's probably about a decade away for that technology is developed. Now, because Caltex's refinery production is significantly less than our sale of petroleum products, we sell about 25% more than we make, for example, a reduction in demand for refined petroleum products translates into lower imports, not lower refining production for Caltex. So as we blend more biofuels, it just means we buy less fuel from offshore. Everything we make, we can sell, and we just blend in biofuels as opposed to imports. Now let's go on to climate change policy issues. We issue our Star magazine to the public every couple of months, and certainly no discussion these days can be complete without discussing Australia's greenhouse gas emission trading scheme. As we call it, the government calls it the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme. This is hardly surprising because the potential impacts on emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries like oil refining are so significant. Oil refining operates on small margins, on average, over the business cycle, and given the capital-intensive nature of business, faces very high carbon mitigation costs expressed as dollars per ton of emissions abated. High costs of carbon emission permits would threaten the viability of the Australian oil refining industry, and we've said that a number of times. Caltex's admission on the government's green paper sets out the impact on the EBIT, or earnings before interest and tax, from Caltex's refining operations. A scenario based on gross refiner margins since 2000 shows that carbon costs would reduce refining EBIT by one-third. This period included both very low and high refiner margins. So Caltex and management and boards generally have to manage what is before them. In the bottom half of the business cycle for refining, carbon costs could consume 100% of the earnings. That was the formula that would certainly be one for shutting down operations, and a number of companies have been out there saying recently, in fact, ExxonMobil was saying that they would regard their refineries vulnerable should there be a high carbon cost. So similar outcomes are faced by many industries. But before everybody panics, I think the carbon pollution reduction scheme is far from finalised, and we have considerable faith in the common sense of government to devise a sensible scheme. Professor Garnaut suggested assistance to emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries, or ETIs, should reflect their long-term international competitiveness in a world where overseas competitors bear the same carbon prices. I believe that most of Australia's emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries could be competitive in a carbon-constrained world that has a level playing field versus offshore competitors. And the key, as in this slide, is level playing field. What is needed is assistance to bridge the time gap until competitors offshore also have carbon costs and we have that level playing field. So let's look now at the purpose of the carbon pollution reduction scheme. And it's the key questions that are raised. One of the key issues relating to the CPRS is its fundamental purpose. Is the CPRS A, a kind of tax to raise revenue for green projects, or B, a way to change the relative prices of goods and services according to their greenhouse gas emissions? Now, this may be an interesting poll. Maybe you should put your hand up, those who think it's A. A few people say A. Anybody want to phone a friend? Who thinks B? Good. I think the overwhelming majority of people who raise their hands think B, and that's correct, because the answer is B. The government says the scheme is intended to deliver abatement and not to adversely affect the distribution of income and wealth. It also says every cent raised will be used to help households and business adjust to the impact of the scheme. This goes to the heart of the issue of assistance for emissions-intensive, trade-exposed industries. It also raises the question of where funding for R&D and industry adjustment schemes should come from. Publicly, funding for R&D is important, and Caltex supports government assistance for R&D where private funding would be inadequate. But normally, if there's a business case, business does the investment in the R&D. There is also a case for adjustment schemes where companies or communities would be disproportionately affected by climate change policies. However, Australia has a long history of funding these activities, these R&D activities, from the budget, the normal budget, and it's hard to see why climate change requires a different approach. We believe all the revenue from the sale of permits should be recycled to households and businesses, not diverted to other uses, because they are the parts of the economy that are going to feel it most and first. So what is the cost impact of CPRS? And we've designated here in terms of electricity generation, stationary energy, including oil refineries, transport, those three main sectors. At $20 per tonne of carbon, and nobody knows where the price is, I mean today in Europe it's about 40, but at $20 per tonne and at about 500 million tonnes of emissions liable for permits in the first year of the scheme, about $10 billion is flying to the government. no one outside the cabinet has seen any calculations on the distribution of the permit revenue yet. This chart shows the major source of emissions in the Australian economy. Electricity generation is the largest, and most of its carbon permit costs will be passed through to consumers. Because basically electricity generators generate electricity in Australia, they'll pay a carbon cost, and they'll include the cost of electricity, of carbon in their electricity costs, and it will come in on people's electricity bills, because there's no offshore competition. Other forms of stationary energy are next, which includes a lot of emissions-intensive, trade-exposed industries, including oil refining and metals manufacturing. This is the second group. These industries can't pass on their permit costs because they compete against offshore industries that bring imports into Australia that have no carbon cost. Transport is also large, but over half of this is private motorists who will have any increase in fuel prices due to carbon credits fully offset by a reduction in excise for the first 3 years of the scheme. The government said promoters will reduce the excise cent for cent to meet the carbon cost, so the tax on petrol, the offset will be the same, so fixed tax plus GST over the first 3 years. So the motorists will feel no impact of higher prices because of carbon. When you look at emissions-intensive trade-exposed industries, what are now called ETI industries, those will contribute about 40% of the permit revenue, so $4 billion of the $10 billion in a $20 world. That 40% actually excludes agriculture. By their nature, as trade-exposed industries, ETIs can't pass on price increases due to carbon costs, so they don't have an impact on households or other businesses. So, for example, we compete against imports of fuel from offshore that doesn't have a carbon cost. That sets the wholesale price. So there's a carbon cost on our refineries. We have to absorb that cost. We can't pass it along because the imports don't have it. However, the Green Paper proposes only 20% of the permits would be allocated free to ETI industries. So ETIs pay 40% of the permits, but only get 20% of free permits back. So that's just about half of the permits they're required to hold for their emissions hence. This 20% shortfall in ETI assistance appears to constitute about a $2 billion annual revenue redistribution from ETI industries to the rest of the economy. And that's we're saying, well, where is that money going to go? Are the benefits of this expenditure greater than the long-term cost to Australian industry in terms of lost investment, jobs, and skills? So basically, an explanation is needed of how the $10 billion of permit revenue is being distributed, and we're looking forward to that coming forth from the government. So let's conclude. Three key points. Climate change and oil supply demand will fundamentally change the long-term business environment, with or without climate change. But with climate change, it accelerates the issue that we're going to move away from fossil fuels as a globe. Caltex's business will continue to evolve. We trace our roots in Australia back to the R.W. Cameron Company of 1900. Now, R.W. Cameron back then was probably selling mostly lamp oil. And I can assure you, we don't sell a lot of lamp oil today. We've evolved, and we'll continue to evolve. And that's just the nature of how businesses stay in business profitably for long periods of time. And the last point is sound climate change policy decisions are critical for the viability of Australian industries. And I think that's why this dialogue that the government's having right now with industry is very healthy, to make sure we end up with the right scheme. Because Australia can take an international leadership position in policies to reduce carbon emissions, but until there is a global commitment to emission reduction, Australia's emission reduction trajectory should be modest and ensure a low carbon price initially. We need to remember, and this is a key point, that Australia can't solve the global problem alone when it comes to climate change. What we can do, though, is show how climate change is a good example where, with the right scheme, Australia can help lead the world to a better future without disadvantaging the Australian economy. That's really a key point. We can't do it alone, but we can show global leadership, get a seat at that global table and say, we've got a scheme in place, now why don't you, to these other countries, but make sure in the early days, until those other countries don't have a scheme, we don't disadvantage our economy by having a too high a carbon price. That way we can show world leadership, which will benefit our economy long term. So look forward to taking any questions. Thank you for your time, and please enjoy your dessert.